You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
Meantime, President Trump taking
Donald Trump and terrorism. That
well, President Trump had a pretty
between
testy.
President Trump and one of our closest military.
Are you tiring of Trump? We'll ask how the media might avoid news fatigue by getting a little more creative with its coverage. My guests Martin Plaut and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Germany is headed for a tense election season. We'll look at how the country and the wider EU might react to a change in the chancellery. Plus, Morocco rejoins the African Union, and a little later.
6 months ago, U.S. Special Forces launched an assault, killing Ben Khalid and his terrorist organization.
Six heroes who risked their lives to stop Ben Khalid from carrying out his threat to attack this country.
Do fictional depictions of terrorism help or hinder our understanding of the real world? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Martin Plaut, Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the show. First, some breaking news as we go to air. Here in the UK, the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, has stated that he does not think that President Trump should be accorded the honour of addressing Parliament when he makes a state visit to the UK this year. Bercow cited Trump's sexism, racism, and menace to judicial independence. Martin, first of all, is this an appropriate intervention by a theoretically neutral figure?
Well, it certainly came as a bolt from the blue. It was an extraordinary moment. I just happened to be watching, and they were discussing whether the clerks of the House of Commons should or should not have horsehair whips, but wigs, when they sit in front of the Speaker. And this was going on for some time.
A topic that is consuming the saloons and cafes
of Great Britain. And then all of a sudden, Bercow, who is a Conservative Member of Parliament, gets up and he says, you know, we don't like this racism, sexism, and he slammed the doors of Parliament in the face of Donald Trump. Of course, that is exactly what happens when the Queen arrives in Parliament every year to deliver her address to Parliament and to show that the House of Commons is independent and cannot be demanded.
Except
that
in this particular instance, Trump doesn't get in after tapping on the door three times with a stick and asking nicely,
indeed,
does he?
Indeed. This is such a blow. And it was an extraordinary moment because the opposition benches, Labour, the Welsh Nationalists, everyone else, erupted in cheers, which never happens in the House, and applause, and the government looked absolutely stony-faced and shocked. It's a huge blow to Mrs. May, who, of course, has been absolutely wooing Mr. Trump. And, you know, this is a huge setback for her.
Quick thought from you on this as well, Sebastian.
My mind still boggles from the whip. I'm still thinking about the whip, the horsehair whip. Sorry, yes,
on your own time, Sebastian, focus.
Well, look, so fascinating. I mean, Bercow isn't, if I may say so, Martin, a Conservative Member of Parliament anymore. He was actually elected as the Speaker at the last
election. Yeah, but he is a Conservative.
He was a Conservative MP. But, of course, he's always been a thorn in the side of his party and his government. Still, I mean, a grave and bitter defeat for the Prime Minister. And again, you can see that any real opposition to Theresa May's government will not come from the Labour Party. It'll come from her own benches. That's the only thing we can hope for in the next 2 days when the House of Commons talks about Brexit, Conservatives get up.
But I think what you're saying there is echoed in the way that quite a lot of the most trenchant opposition to Donald Trump in the United States appears to be coming from his well, nominal fellow Republicans. We will stay with Trump because to get to the first of this evening's topics, he promised change, and on that he has delivered, in as much as a wild bull would change the inventory of a China shop. Donald Trump's presidency could be charitably described, at least so far, as chaotic. But the remorseless barrage of Trump-related outrages and mishaps disguises another problem. As one cartoonist quipped, my desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to remain sane. News fatigue, it can be a real issue. So how can media organisations ensure that their audiences remain informed without, to put too fine a point on it, boring them? Martin, first of all, where are you on the idea that this is deliberate strategy by the Trump White House to just throw up this absolute wall of chaff, of disinformation, of chaos, of mishap, so no one has any idea what's going on, and eventually people get worn out? Because I stress, he's been president for 17 days. It feels like 17 years.
I completely agree. And I think the last thing anyone's getting is bored by this man. I mean, he is still absolutely fascinating. We can't get used to it because, as you say, it completely destroys the sort of normal way in which governments operate. And, you know, I think it is a strategy. I think it is designed to disrupt and to, as he put it, drain the swamp. I mean, the fact that he is part of the swamp is a different question, but I mean, that is the whole rhetoric, is to come at things from a completely different way and to churn up opposition and to churn up his supporters so that they come out and support him. But I mean, you know, one has to remember two things. First of all, he did not win the popular vote. He was 3 million votes behind Hillary Clinton, even though he won the election fair and square. And also that his opinion poll ratings are the lowest of any president in living memory.
Yeah, all fake news. Fake news, all negative polls, he has declared today, are fake news.
Unfortunately, he cannot talk out the judiciary and the facts that are against him. And the facts are against him, whatever he says.
The facts, as we have discussed many times, Martin, are a terrifically 20th century concept. Sebastian, how does the media, or how should the media adjust to this? How can you report on somebody who does keep insisting that black is white and that 2 + 2 = 5?
Well, you maintain the facts, which were facts in the 20th and remain facts in the 21st century. Black is black and white is white. And you have to call them out every time. I would have thought we maybe are getting a little bit hysterical sometimes. Totally understandable because he is so wacky and so out of any normal rules of behavior. But I think much better to stay calm, maybe ignore one or two of his provocations, but clearly remain on the case. I mean, a president calling a federal judge, a so-called judge, a president saying that all the opinion polls are fake news, that can't stand. And the media are very, very important in calling it out again and again.
Because there is a question there, isn't there, Martin, about which of the provocations and outbursts the media should ignore? Because Donald Trump does belong essentially to that modern class of professional attention seekers and village idiots, people who, you know, make a living by doing, saying outrageous and stupid things. The wisest policy is usually, of course, to completely ignore them. But you can't do that when one of them has somehow managed to get himself elected president. How does the media stop being what I think the media was during a lot of his campaign, and an enabler of Trump, and instead become a reporter, chronicler, and questioner of Trump?
Well, I think, you know, the answer for all media all the time is always to focus on your audience. Who are you trying to address? What are their concerns? How do you serve them? It's a very simple recipe. And as long as you amuse, entertain, and inform your audience, they will stick with you. And, there will be people who do not want to hear any criticism of Mr. Trump. And they are now absolutely adequately served by people like Fox News and Breitbart and so forth. So, you know, everybody now, in a sense, that's one of the problems that we live in. We live in an age where whatever your tastes are, you can be served. whether it's hardline pornography or it is, you know, the most wacky news thing, you know, that, that Elvis has landed on the moon. Again. Whatever you want, you can find answers to it. That is one of our problems. There isn't any longer, shall we say, the village pump around which everybody stands and chats. People have their own views, but that there is no alternative but to try to go on serving them.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Sebastian's homeland, where Angela Merkel's Conservative colleagues are standing by the Chancellor as the nation's election season heats up. Recent political tensions over Angela Merkel's migrant policies were put aside at the meeting today in Munich. The Christian Democratic Union preparing to stare down a challenge by the Social Democrats and its surprise new leader, former European Parliament President Martin Schulz. Sebastian, who are Martin Schulz's people? Who is he appealing to? Who does he take away from Angela Merkel?
Well, I mean, the complaint of a lot of people in her own party, of course, over the last few years has been that she's been too much of a centrist and not conservative enough. So that quite different from America. We're still talking about an election fought about the center ground of society, and these are the people that she was very good at winning and keeping in her camp, and who might be tempted, first of all, by just sheer longevity of her government, but also by the quite forceful personality of Martin Schulz to consider the Social Democrats. I have to say, I'm slightly skeptical whether this doesn't turn out to be a winter bubble which will melt by the spring. Because, I mean, he hasn't been in domestic politics for 23 years. Whenever you ask him a detailed question, there's very little of that. Whereas, of course, Merkel is the ultimate detail politician, and I also think that people will focus on the only chance he has of building a government without the Conservatives, namely to go into coalition with the Greens and the Left Party, in other words, the former communists in East Germany, who are still, you know, who are very far away from the center of society and who are still beyond the pale for a lot of center thinking Germans.
Martin, how disorienting effect on this election will be the apparent or at least possible recalibration of the world around Germany? Because Germany now has to adjust for the possibility that the President of the United States isn't terrifically interested in Europe, that the United Kingdom is going to leave the EU, and that France may well elect a president who is not terrifically interested in the EU or the Eurozone, etc., etc. Is it reasonable to expect Germany to step up and take even more of a leadership role in Europe than it presently possesses?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, I think the thing that Germany has, you know, branded upon it is the implications of disorder and chaos. And, you know, no German is ever going to, you know, of our generation or the current generation is ever going to forget what the 30s did to Germany and what disorder can bring. And whether it
what
is...
What Germany did to Europe.
Indeed. But, I mean, you know, internally, what it did, you know, either the communists or the fascists, what they did. And so, I mean, the notion of the attraction of the center ground is very substantial. And, you know, yes, obviously, you know, people have had huge difficulties in absorbing 900,000, you know, migrants and then, you know, which is now tailing off, you know. But, you know, I still think that the center ground is enormously powerful in Germany. And for, you know, I think that that will mean that they will remain the center ground of Europe. And I don't think Marie Le Pen is going to be elected in France. And you will have, again, Germany and France holding the center ground of Europe. Now, when I say that Marie Le Pen will not be elected, I'm not saying that she won't do well and that she won't have powerful allies if she was going to be elected. And you can hold me to my promise, my prediction in a few months' time when I'm proved wrong.
So, Sebastian, how relaxed or comfortable would Germany be with the idea that if the US and the UK and possibly France detach themselves even slightly from Europe, that Germany might be obliged to play a greater role in the continent's defence?
Can I just finish that thought about the elections? I think the if Le Pen gets elected, I think people have even more of an incentive to stay with Angela Merkel. You know, obviously, security, a safe pair of hands. The leading role in Europe is something which is slowly filtering through. The elite, I think, are aware of that and want to are trying the tried old method, which Adenauer, Brandt and Kohl used to do. In other words, bring the neighbours in as much as you can and obviously rely on the axis with France. I think it will still need some persuasion, some education for the people to understand that and to understand that, that with responsibility come certain difficult decisions. More money for defense, for example. I mean, Germany spends 1.4% of GDP, which doesn't add up as far as the NATO target of 2% is concerned. Possibly more blood and treasure in military, you know, within the EU or within NATO. And also increasingly the fact that we will, the Germany will be in Europe what America has long been in the world. In other words, the super cop who always gets the blame. Either they do something and people complain, or they don't do something and people complain.
But is Germany ready for that role, though, or at least an expansion of that role? Because there is still a discomfort and an awkwardness with the idea of sending troops abroad, for example, in Germany, or at least to a greater extent than there is in most other Western countries.
In I'm not sure whether that's in most other countries. I think Britain is an exception in that sense. Maybe France, just because they were former imperial powers.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think it's pretty similar in the Netherlands.
So too, of course, was Germany before the Second World War.
Before the First World War.
First World War.
Before the First World War. Yes. Italy and Netherlands, etc. I think they're fairly similar to Germany in that sense. Yes, there is reluctance there, no doubt. But I think politically, it's increasingly being accepted that there is more to do.
Okay, just final quick thought from you on the election as it stands, Sebastian. The good news is that polls are showing Alternative for Deutschland sort of marooned at 11% or thereabouts. Are they as big as they're ever going to get?
Yes. I've always thought, give them 12. Give them possibly 14 if something very dreadful happens in the summer, but absolutely no more than that.
Okay, well, on that somewhat hopeful note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Martin Plaut and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, Morocco's reappearance at the African Union, and do fictional depictions of terrorism help or hinder our understanding? Stay tuned.
Okay, so 2016 wasn't the greatest of years, but don't worry, there are plenty of reasons why 2017 will be better. And we've packed lots of them into more than 250 pages of the new edition of the Monocle Forecast. It's the magazine for those who want to look over the horizon and spot the new opportunities the new year will bring. From the rising global powers to keep an eye on, to the startups to invest in, and the cities you'll want to call home. It's packed with opinion and wit, with ideas and provocations, and guaranteed to keep you talking all the way through 2017. The Monocle Forecast. Buy your copy today and know what's happening tomorrow.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Martin Plaut and Sebastian Borger. Now, as of last week, Morocco is once again a member of the African Union after an absence of more than three decades. Morocco cut ties with the AU after the AU recognised the independence of the disputed Western Sahara territory. Many hope that the readmission will pave the way for a truce, though Morocco's foreign minister maintains that his country will never recognise Western Sahara. This has, as we note there, Martin, been a long-running schism. Why is Morocco suddenly so keen to rejoin?
I think they've felt on the edge of African politics for a long time, and having the Western Sahara, or to give them their correct title, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, part of the AU, and them not being part of it, put them at a disadvantage, because at least nominally the AU would do everything in on behalf of its members, and therefore that left Morocco isolated. But, I mean, in reality, everybody knows that things are going nowhere. It's about as stuck as the Kashmir situation, to draw an analogy. And it's a good analogy, in a sense, because both of them were promised referenda on their future, and both have been blocked by the major powers.
Is there a way of unsticking it, though? Because there was some speculation last May, when the long-time Polisario leader Mohamed Abdelaziz died, that perhaps a subsequent generation not as beholden to the dogmatic positions of the past, etc., 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 a lot, you know, coupled with the fact that there is a youngish and relatively reformist king in Morocco, there was some optimism at large. Is there actually any solution anywhere in the vicinity?
No. I mean, honestly, I don't think there is. I think the poor Polisario will be rotting in their tents in the appalling refugee camps on the edge of, on the edge of their country in Algeria for as long as you can imagine. I see absolutely no way of going forward. The Moroccans have said they are certainly not going to recognize the SADR, despite the fact that they're both now members of the African Union. So I think it's as stuck as Kashmir.
Sebastian, as a sort of pro-European European, are you encouraged at some level by the idea of a country seeking to join a continental union of its neighbours?
Well, obviously.
It's running against prevailing fashion.
It does, doesn't it? But it's so interesting, isn't it, that you can join something. It would be a bit similar if Serbia joined the European Union and said, but we don't recognise Croatia's territorial integrity. I mean, very odd, but which I suppose also tells you something about the very different leeway and leverage that the EU has as compared to the Organization of African Union, I should call it, which is really not much more than a talking shop, is it?
Indeed. Or to use a term that Yoweri Museveni, the Ugandan president, once called it a club for dictators, of which he isn't, which he is now happily joined, of course. to be fair to the AU, it has improved in recent years and has done a few things, although don't press me too hard to get beyond one or two.
Just finally on this, though, Martin, the welcome was not unequivocal. It was 39 states voting to take Morocco back, 15 against. What would be the objection? Is it the Western Sahara thing?
Well, I refer you to the remarks of that honourable leader, Robert Mugabe, who said that allowing them back in was a result of financial muscle. I think it's a lack of ideology. They, the African leaders who backed Morocco, have not had the same revolutionary experience as all of us had, and they're too much reliance on the erstwhile colonisers. So there we are. We now know.
Always good to hear from him. Finally today, very few would accuse the television series 24 of taking itself too seriously, or indeed of being worth taking seriously. But the new season, which premiered in the coveted post-Super Bowl slot, delayed obviously for overtime, seems to be playing right into America's absurdly inflated fears of Islamic terrorism. The New York Times called the first episode an hour-long ad for Islamophobia, while the executive producer did reassure the Hollywood Reporter that although the series may start as if it were written by Trump, it ends as if it were written by Clinton. The show is obviously meant to be fun, but it does exploit real-life fear. So the question is, what responsibility, if any, do the writers have to help us understand the issues behind the programme? Sebastian, nobody expects James Bond films to be documentaries. Does this actually matter?
I, to be honest, I mean, I read this review in the New York Times, and I just think, well, these I get a glimpse of an understanding why Donald Trump hates that paper so much. I just find it over the top. I mean, don't underestimate people's intelligence. I mean, not even Americans' intelligence. they've grown up. They've grown. They, as any generation now really on Earth, have grown up with moving pictures, with depictions of people in fictional films or television series like that. I just, you know, obviously you want well-researched stuff. Obviously, you don't want, you know, propaganda struck down people's throat. But I can't believe that people will, unless they are already totally convinced that Islam is, as the president's chief advisor Bannon keeps saying, is a terrible threat to all of us rather than a religion of peace. I don't think that a television series will change their minds.
Yeah, I mean, whenever this or similar arguments in different media come up, it does always strike me that I have been listening to Johnny Cash records for many years and have never once shot a man in Reno just to watch him die, and nor do I have any ambition of so doing.
Aren't we glad to hear it?
Martin, it wouldn't... But if you are... I mean, I guess there's the opposite argument as well, that if you're making a show like 24 or Homeland or something of that ilk, a sort of espionage thriller set in the here and now, it would be kind of perverse if the bad guys weren't Islamist terrorists, wouldn't it?
I completely agree. And I mean, you know, they used to, a few years ago, they were all Soviet agents. But now the Soviet agents seem to be Mr. Trump's friends. So, you know, it's all a bit confusing. But, you know, the one thing I would say is, you know, that if you travel around the Arab world a bit, you see plenty of... anti-Western and anti-Christian and particularly anti-Jewish, you know, propaganda in the way of films. You know, I remember visiting the madrasa where Mullah Omar was trained before the invasion of Afghanistan in Pakistan, and the mullah came down and he said to me, not Mullah Omar, but I mean the mullah of the madrasa came down and he said, you know, after 9/11. I came down and I reassured my colleagues here that this was only Zionists that had destroyed the Twin Towers. And there are plenty of films that you can see showing that Zionists and the Israelis destroying the Twin Towers that had nothing to do. So, I mean, you know, this kind of propaganda goes on everywhere. It's not just Hollywood.
Is this an affectation of, I guess, the Sebastian, the perpetually outraged social media age? There does seem to me, and it's not just TV programs, it comes up quite frequently about music, about literature, about film. People see art and entertainment as not something that they should enjoy, but something that they need to approve of.
Yeah, I mean, we've had scandals like that since time immemorial, haven't we? I mean, and I have to say, of course, moving pictures maybe are a little bit different, for example, from words on a page, because there's a different cognitive process going on there, and it may, if you manage, which of course a lot of these modern television series do, if you manage to more or less imitate pictures that you've seen in news broadcasts, then, you know, borders can get rather blurred. There's no doubt about it. I still wouldn't worry too much about it.
I mean, Martin, if you are producing a sort of, you know, daft, high-octane espionage action thriller in this day and age, are you obliged at any level to sort of use it as a vehicle of social progress? Is it permissible in, I guess, what you might call sort of tense and fearful times to just be entirely amoral and just fill your program with car chases and explosions and cartoonish good guys and equally cartoonish bad guys?
I don't think you have very much of an obligation to be on the right side of political correctness. I think one can go too far with it. I mean, you know, let's not forget that there were, you know, children of in my generation were brought up with nursery rhymes which included 10 little, and I cannot even say the word what they were, boys sitting in a row.
Indeed.
I cannot even say the word, and yet all of us in the in the English speaking world knew what that nursery rhyme
was. It's also well within living memory that the UK pop charts were topped by a song called "I've Never Met a Nice South African."
Indeed, of which I'm one. So there you go. And I don't think any of us have been destroyed by it. So I think we need a little more faith in humankind.
Well, on that forgiving and conciliatory note, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Martin Plaut and Sebastian Borger. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, research by Anthea Longo and Tom Furse. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next, 1900 Hours, Robert Bound heads to Los Angeles to meet the mysterious forces behind Netflix. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.